Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Stephen Arvin, registration number 39020, representing Mr. Keysan Cox. Due to an error on the part of the trial court, Mr. Cox was convicted by a jury that may have been persuaded by expert testimony and conclusions that were ostensibly based upon the scientific method, but in fact might not have been based upon reliable scientific principles as required under People v. Schreck, and worse, might not have been based upon science at all. Specifically at trial, an expert witness named Tom Bell testified for the prosecution and informed the jury that through application of the scientific method, he had reached several conclusions that effectively refuted Mr. Cox's theory of defense, which was self-defense. In closing argument, the prosecution relied on Mr. Bell's credibility to persuade the jury of Mr. Cox's guilt. The prosecution referred to Mr. Bevel's testimony several times, and at one point even referred to Mr. Bevel as an expert among experts. Before trial, however, Mr. Cox was denied an opportunity to test the reliability of the purported scientific method upon which Mr. Bevel claimed his opinion were based.
Mr. Arvin, I have a question about that. You can look at the Schreck hearing on two levels. One would be a challenge to the science of crime scene reconstruction in general, and the other would be a more specific challenge to some of the testimony that this expert provided, which may or may not have been based on those principles of crime scene reconstruction. And I think what I'm trying to clarify is, which level are you attacking? The failure to hold the Schreck hearing on both levels at this point, or only one level?
Both levels, Your Honor. In Mr. Cox's request for a Schreck hearing, he challenged specific testimony that Mr. Bevel gave concerning the notion that the crime scene was staged. And Mr. Cox's counsel also warned the court that it was impossible to determine if there was really some scientific process here or if these are merely hunches based on experience, referring to Mr. Bevel's conclusions. So I think that gets to it gets to the specific testimony that Mr. Bevel offered, obviously regarding the idea that the crime scene was staged, and also gets to what appears to be a problem in that some of Mr. Bevel's conclusions were simply based on speculation rather than science.
That would have to do with the basement issue.
That's the most obvious one, yes, sir.
And was that put in the motion?
That was not specifically challenged in the motion.
Okay.
The trial court denied Mr. Cox's request for a Schreck hearing on the basis that Mr. Cox's request did not indicate what the opinions of this expert, Tom Bevel, are. But as I've mentioned, in Mr. Cox's request for a Schreck hearing, he specified that he was challenging the notion that Mr. Bevel's assertion that Mr. Cox staged the crime scene, and further had the defense counsel further mentioned that Mr. Bevel would testify that the shooting in this case transpired in a certain way. And as I also mentioned, the defense counsel raised the notion that it is difficult to tell whether or not Mr. Bevel had actually based his opinions upon some sort of scientific process. I think this was more than enough to inform the court of what Mr. Bevel's opinions were in order to trigger a Schreck hearing.
And in this regard, you're referring to your... what's the date of the motion that you're referring to?
Well, there are two motions, Your Honor.
Right. And are you referring to the 2010?
October 2005.
Excuse me.
The first motion was filed on this matter. In that motion, defense counsel sought to challenge Mr. Bevel's opinion that the crime scene was staged. Counsel did not specifically name Mr. Bevel in that motion. Counsel referred simply to expert testimony. But the defense counsel, as you already filed a second motion, and I apologize, I don't know that, I don't have the date of that motion.
That one was in January of 2006.
That sounds correct, Your Honor. And in that motion, defense counsel did specifically refer to Mr. Bevel, did specifically identify Mr. Bevel as a witness that they were challenging.
And then the court ruled in February of, or the court heard the matter in February of 2006.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
And what was the ruling at that time?
At that point, the court ruled that it did not have sufficient information regarding the opinions that Mr. Bevel was prepared to give.
In light of that ruling, was there any effort made to provide the court with more specific information about those opinions?
There was not, Your Honor. At that point, I don't believe defense counsel was required to give the court any more specific information. I think what defense counsel had already given the court was specific enough.
The prosecution was ordered to provide defendant with a report setting forth the specific opinions of Dr. Bevel as part of that order, was it not? But there's no way that information would have gotten to the court.
I don't know if that information went to the court. That is part of the court's order. That's correct. But apparently, the defense counsel did have awareness of some awareness of what Mr. Bevel's opinions would be because they referenced his opinions in their previous request for a Shrek hearing. Roughly around the time the opening brief in this case was filed, People v. Rector issued from the Colorado Supreme Court and clarified the level of specificity that is required in order to trigger a Shrek hearing. And I think it's useful to understand this case is by distinguishing it from People v. Rector. In People v. Rector, the Colorado Supreme Court addressed a case where defense counsel requested a Shrek hearing on the shaken, and an expert's testimony regarding the shaken baby syndrome. At pretrial hearings, the prosecution informed the court that it did not plan to elicit any testimony regarding shaken baby. Therefore, the trial court did not grant a Shrek hearing because at that point, there was obviously no point in holding one. Later at trial, an expert witness different than the one the defense counsel had challenged testified that based on his opinion, child abuse had occurred. And on appeal, defendant appealed the testimony of the witness who testified at trial regarding his opinion concerning child abuse. The Supreme Court found that a Shrek hearing was not required in that case because, first off, the prosecution had stated that it was not planning on eliciting any testimony regarding shaken baby. Also, the opinions that were given by the expert at trial were did not relate to the testimony that defense counsel sought to challenge before trial. And also, the witness who testified was different than the witness who defense counsel sought to challenge before trial. Here, the witness who testified at trial is the same witness who we challenged and sought to hold a Shrek hearing on before trial. And this witness also testified to opinions that we sought to challenge before trial. And even though we did not specifically mention in our Shrek hearing the witness's potential testimony regarding the victim in the basement, we did mention that the witness would testify that the events during the alleged crime had happened and had transpired in a certain way. And this was noticed to the court that Mr. Bevel would offer the types of opinions that resulted in his testimony regarding what transpired in the basement.
Mr. Cox, I have some difficulty with what happened at trial, because at trial, when Bevel was called, the defense counsel said that he would continue the, or she would, but the defendant would continue the objection. And then when given a chance to voir dire, Mr. Bevel said that that the defendant would stand on the record. Mm-hmm. My concern is whether that's sufficient to have preserved the issue at trial to tell the court that, Judge, we have a problem, that we want a Shrek hearing, we haven't had a Shrek hearing, And what we're going to do is we're going to stand on the record, and the record being that you haven't ruled yet. Because the February ruling, in effect, the court said, I don't have enough information to rule. And the court apparently deferred ruling.
Well, I think the defense counsel's two motions pretrial were sufficient to preserve its objection to the client's testimony under Schreck. I don't necessarily, I can respectfully disagree with you on your interpretation of the trial court's ruling. I don't interpret that as the court deferring its ruling. I think the court was merely stating that it was not going to rule on the Schreck hearing, going to grant a Schreck hearing because, in its opinion, it didn't have enough information. But the court didn't suggest in the order that defense counsel should submit further information. Like I mentioned, defense counsel filed two motions requesting a Schreck hearing that sufficiently identified the expert that was going to testify and what he would testify to. The errors on the part of the trial court in refusing to hold a Schreck hearing or make any findings on the matter, I don't think that error should weigh against Mr. Cox. I don't think he was obliged to renew his request another Schreck hearing at trial. I think he'd satisfied the requirements of Schreck and Rector with his pretrial requests. And as you mentioned, that trial did object to the testimony of Mr. Bevel, which I think
so there's no obligation to reorient the court. I mean, after all, this had been some 9 months earlier that the court had ruled in February, and was not 9 months earlier. As I recall, the court had ruled in February. This was October, and the question comes up, and counsel doesn't even say, Your Honor, our objection is that you never held a Schreck hearing. You have no obligation to say to the court, specify to the court an objection that gives the court an opportunity to give you what you want.
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because defense counsel had already done that. Defense counsel had already given the court that opportunity, and the trial court erred in failing to hold a Schreck hearing.
So at that point, are you just kind of holding the trial court to its error and saying, we'll proceed now without our Schreck hearing and hope we get a fair trial? And, I mean, don't you have an obligation to make a contemporaneous objection to afford yourself a fair trial and to let the court know that court judge, we've asked for a Schreck hearing and we still haven't had it?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. Not when you sufficiently alerted the court as to your concerns regarding Schreck and given the court sufficient information to trigger a hearing. I think at that point, as I mentioned, I think the requirements of Schreck and Rector have been met. And I don't think at that point it's not necessary to belabor the notion that a Schreck hearing needs to be held. And I believe it's because the Rector of the Supreme Court, in a footnote, emphasized that if possible, a trial court should hold a Schreck hearing before the trial is held. And from the defense counsel's perspective, when it has already been denied a Schreck hearing after offering the adequate information, I don't think defense counsel should be expected to again request a Schreck hearing. As you mentioned, defense counsel did object to the expert's testimony and sit on its previous record, therefore alerting the court of that record, but I don't think it was required to submit.
And as far as pretrial motions, no obligation then to renew with a motion in limine to exclude the testimony?
Not after filing two requests for a Schreck hearing, no, Your Honor. I don't think so.
Thank you.
If this court has no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
May it please the court, my name is Brock Swanson, attorney registration number 39116, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado on this matter. At trial, it was undisputed that the defendant shot and killed his girlfriend, TM, and her friend, Ian. The only issue was whether he acted in self-defense. Tiam was shot once in the head with a revolver from relatively close range. In her hand was an unfired handgun. While Tiam owned a handgun, that gun was locked in a safe in her bedroom. The gun in her hand was purchased by the defendant and had only the defendant's DNA on it. Based on an analysis of the crime scene, the people's expert in crime scene reconstruction and blood spatter analysis opined that the gun was likely placed in Tiam's hand after she was shot. Ian was shot a total of four times. She was shot three times in the basement of the house with the same revolver that killed Tiam. The final shot occurred while she was unarmed, lying in the chair on top of that now empty revolver. According to the defendant's own expert witness, the defendant took another gun, put it directly against her head, and then pulled the trigger, killing her. The defendant had a strong and clear motive for killing the two women. Among other things, the defendant believed, mistakenly it turned out, that he had just discovered evidence that Tiam had stolen a large sum of money from him. He had previously told multiple people that he would kill whoever had stolen his money. And in the defendant's own words, he shot Ian because he didn't want any witnesses. On appeal, the defendant first challenges the trial court's failure to hold a pretrial Shrek hearing. The purpose of a Shrek hearing is to determine three things. One, whether an area of expertise is sufficiently reliable to be discussed at trial. Two, whether the expert to be called is qualified to opine in that area of expertise. And three, whether discussion of that area of expertise would be helpful to the jury under the facts of the case. A Shrek hearing is not a discovery device. Rule 16 extensively regulates the discovery of expert opinions, including mandatory disclosures, as well as mechanisms for seeking additional disclosures at the discretion of the trial court. And I think Rector recognizes that it is premature to hold a Shrek hearing before that discovery has been completed. A Shrek hearing is also not an opportunity to dispute the application of an area of expertise to the particular facts of the case. Such arguments go to the weight of the evidence, not its admissibility, and are not properly probed in a Shrek hearing.
Just once, and I need to interrupt the flow of your argument, but I want to turn to the testimony about what may or may not have happened in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree that that testimony, at least as it relates to the principles of crime scene reconstruction, was somewhat speculative?
I don't think we can conclusively answer that question based on this record. I think there might be a natural inclination to question whether the experts, because both the prosecution's and the defense counsel's experts opined in this area, were really applying their expertise during these discussions. However, I think what the record does clearly indicate is that the defendant not only failed to challenge these opinions, but affirmatively took the position in the trial court that these experts could render these opinions and give expert opinions in these areas. It was the defendant who first injected this line of questioning into the case through cross-examination of Mr. Bevel, the prosecutor's expert, and it was one of the primary opinions that the defendant introduced through his own expert, Mr. Koziel, who's qualified in essentially the same areas as Mr. Bevel. So I think having deliberately and strategically injected this issue into the proceeding, this court should decline to review for error. And I think another aspect of that is that because there was no discussion, there was no objection, there is no record on and analyzing whether they were qualified to render these opinions. And so the record cannot establish that they were erroneously given, that they were non-reliable. Here, I think the defendant's motions did not sufficiently present any challenge to warrant a Shrek hearing. Indeed, defendant's final arguments motion, which was the January motion, was quite clear on the defendant's position, which was that Mr. Bevel's report was not clear enough for the defendant to determine whether there was a Shrek challenge available or not. The appropriate response to that position was, as the trial court ordered, more discovery, not holding a premature Shrek hearing. And the court did order extensive discovery beyond the mandatory disclosures that are required under Rule 16. And it required him to explain the bases for his opinion and to essentially give the kind of disclosure that would be required in a civil case that cited the CF to the CRCP reference. Because the trial court appropriately addressed the defendant's motion, the people's position is that this court should affirm the trial court's ruling there. Judge Vogt commented on whether the court would be aware of what the reports were. There was a one report that the people filed in after the trial court initially ruled that it didn't have enough information to address the challenge. The people did file a copy of the expert's first report. However, there were, at trial, it was revealed that there were two subsequent reports after this that the expert prepared, and we don't have any record of what those reports contained because they're not in the record and they were never brought to the trial court's opinion or attention. So, does the court have any further questions?
Oh, actually, I have a question on the provocation instruction issue.
Absolutely.
And it has to do with your application of Dunaway.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if I'm understanding your argument correctly, you're saying the way that the affirmative defense works, they have to actually disprove as an element. And if there are other ways of disproving the self-defense, then the Dunaway principle kicks in. Am I understanding the argument correctly?
That's right.
Okay. Under that understanding of the argument, then, when would a provocation instruction ever not be harmless error?
Actually giving a legally correct instruction, even if it was not supported by the evidence, I think would always be harmless error in and of itself. Now, potentially, the giving of it could induce the counsel to make arguments that were inappropriate, to argue that it would apply in situations that it was not. And I think Dunaway makes this clear, the best practice would be not to give these instructions, extra instructions, even if legally correct, when they are not supported by the evidence. But I think doing so, so long as the instructions themselves are correct statements of the law, is not reversible error.
So your argument basically would eliminate lack of support by the evidence, would eliminate as a grounds for reversal for the giving of a legally correct provocation instruction or an instruction of that nature.
Yes, and I think that Dunaway has already, it's not all, on all fours, has done a lot of that. I mean, if you instruct on multiple ways of committing an offense, and they are not supported by the evidence, it is just not reversible error.
Well, Dunaway is a little different in that it talks about ways of proving the commission of an offense, and this would be talking about ways of disproving defensive theory.
I don't think that is a distinction that has any real substance behind it, in the sense that, if I can explain, when you're giving the self-defense instruction, you are essentially saying, defense counsel, you must prove one of these things. And one of these things would be the defendant provoked an initial attack. The defendant was an initial aggressor. The defendant could not have reasonably believed that he was faced with an imminent threat of harm. A number of different options of things that the defense, that the prosecution must prove beyond a reasonable doubt in order to for the jury to find the defendant guilty of the crime. So I think the exact wording, whether it's disprove this beyond a reasonable doubt or prove this beyond a reasonable doubt, is not a distinction of substance that should be a basis for applying a different understanding or rule to the giving of additional affirmative defense limitations as opposed to different ways of committing the crime itself. I think ultimately it comes down to the underlying reasoning in Dunaway and Griffin, which is that we presume that the juries are able to make factual findings, and that if there is no evidence to support a factual finding, that they're not going to be making that finding, that the risk of that is so small that we're not going to find reversible error based on that remote possibility when there are legitimate reasons for finding this supported by sufficient evidence.
Well, yeah, I guess the trouble I'm having with that is, doesn't it do away with the whole body of law that says there has to be evidentiary support for instructions? And you're saying if there's no evidentiary support, then you just presume that the jury finds otherwise or doesn't accept it.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to say that it does away with it. The delay was clear that it is still improper or not best practice to give these instructions, and the court should not do that. It should not give instructions that aren't supported by the evidence. I think that is a separate issue, though, as to whether it is reversible error to do so. And I think that the Dunaway and the reasoning in it has concluded that it is not reversible error to violate that prohibition.
Apart from this esoteric discussion, whether it's ever reversible error, just give me the nutshell summary of what evidence there was to show, or that could have shown, that the victim provoked by defendant attacked defendant first.
Okay, and I didn't go into this in much detail in my brief, but let me try and point out some evidence here. I think the key here, or one key aspect here, is motive. The defendant had a motive to attack the victims, while the victims did not appear to have any motive to attack the defendant. The account that the defendant gave to various witnesses was essentially that the victims both armed themselves with handguns and intended to kill him, and that's what prompted his attack on them. If this is true, it begs the question why they intended to attack him and kill him. And one potential answer is that the defendant provoked them to do so. And I think there is circumstantial evidence supporting that theory.
And that's what I'd like to know.
Number one, defendant told TM and a number of other people that he would kill whoever stole his money. Two, shortly before the shootings, the defendant called TM and told her that she needed to come home because she had done something way wrong. Three, a torn bank statement was found near TM's body, and a similar bank statement was found in the defendant's pocket when he was arrested. Four, a neighbor heard yelling coming from the house shortly before the shootings. Five, the defendant was armed with a revolver and able to react to any attack from TM before she could fire a shot. And six, finally, after the shootings, the defendant told a cellmate that he did not feel any remorse because he had wanted to kill TM for stealing his money. So I think under these circumstances, there was some credible evidence, which is a low threshold, that if the victims attacked the defendant, it was because the defendant had provoked them to do so to provide a pretext for him to kill them.
And that the evidence that they might have, in fact, attacked him first would have been the fact that they were found with guns in her...
That would be his...
under his theory.
To different people saying they attacked me or they leaked out and tried to kill me. That testimony came in from other people. His assertion of self-defense itself was that they had attacked him first. There are no further questions. The people would ask this court to affirm the defendant's convictions.
Thank you. Bailiff, would you give Mr. Arvin an additional minute? We took up a lot of his time with questions. Pardon me? Give him an additional minute.
I would point out the record does not support the notion that defense counsel somehow conceded to the scientific basis of Mr. Bevel's conclusions. That, as we've talked about, defense counsel asked for Shrek hearings to challenge the scientific basis of those conclusions. And defense counsel also objected at trial to the qualification of Mr. Bevel as an expert witness.
Judge Boris asked at the outset whether you were challenging the broader concept that crime scene reconstruction evidence and blood spatter evidence was not a scientifically recognized discipline. I had understood you to say, yes, it was challenged on that basis. But in fact, if defendant proffered an expert on precisely the same basis, then does that alter your answer?
No, Your Honor. The science that these experts might have been relying on, of course, could have been different. They could have drawn their conclusions from different fields of science. And ultimately, I think the problem we have is that there's simply no record as to what sort of science Mr. Bevel relied upon in reaching his conclusions. And that's because of the trial court's error. We don't even have any findings from the trial court as to what as to whether or not Shrek was satisfied. So we're left with an empty record in that respect. And I would point out what the Colorado Supreme Court said in Developed People, where there are holes in the record that reduce pertinent inquiries on appeal to speculation. Those holes should not weigh against the defendant if those holes are the fault of the trial court. And that's what we have here. Due to the trial court's failure to properly apply the law under Shrek, we don't have a record as to whether or not Shrek was satisfied. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Again, very good arguments to be very useful to us. This opinion has now been submitted. We will issue this case has now been submitted, and we'll issue an opinion in due course.